This is John DeFaub from John Sandoz Bookshop in London. My guest for our podcast today is Roland Phillips. It's not the first time he's done this for us. During the pandemic, he talked about his biography of Mathilde Carr, Victoire, a true story of espionage and resistance in World War II. Now he returns to talk with me about his new book, Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement. Roland, welcome.
Thank you very much for asking me to be here.
Why did you choose to do a biography of Casement?
I chose Casement because amongst all the recent and much needed conversations about colonialism, I was interested to write about an anti-colonial British person. I'd always known a bit about Casement. I'd known about his execution during the First World War. And thinking about colonialism and the Congo and Africa in particular, I wanted to explore what made a great humanitarian well ahead of his time, the what made him also a traitor. And so it's the tragic rise and fall that interested me.
Okay, so the colonialism, which we'll come back to, and the significance of that for him. His story is not very familiar to the generality of readers now, and it really is an extraordinary one. Tell us, first of all, who he was, a little about his origins.
So he, you're right, he is not that well known except by name, and I think part of that, which we'll come on to, is the way he was written out of history after his execution. So his origins, his mother's origins are very obscure, and I think that was part of his motivation. I concluded that in the end she died when he was nine, she was probably the illegitimate daughter of an Anglo-Irish family. He was born in Dublin. His father was a rather cast-out member of a prosperous farming family in County Antrim in the north of Ireland, who had held a commission in an Indian Army regiment, which he'd then sold on. And Casement was the youngest son of these parents. Mother, I think, was probably alcoholic. Father may well have been too. And they lived a pretty dysfunctional existence in boarding houses in Dorking and the outer suburbs of London. They had no money. His father was dependent on handouts from his prosperous Northern Irish uncles. And it was a pretty dysfunctional upbringing, which I think, particularly being orphaned, his father died when he was 12. And I think that lack of emotional certainty drove a lot of his actions thereafter.
And the actions, the first time, you begin the book with his arrival in West Africa, where he'd been given a job by his uncle or his cousin's husband, who he'd been living with in Liverpool. And so suddenly he was the agent for a shipping company in West Africa, and he turns up in what is now the Congo, aged
18. He left school at 15, went to live with his uncle, as you say, and aunt in Liverpool, where his uncle worked for the shipping company that had the monopoly on the Belgian Congo, which had only come into being in 1885, the Free State, so three years earlier. And he was desperate to escape England because he felt he didn't belong, I think, back to his upbringing. And so he went to the Congo as a purser on one of the shipping company's ships and stayed. And he did, it's quite shadowy, his early years in the Congo, but he worked for Stanley, who was still exploring the Congo.
In what capacity?
He worked for Stanley as a surveyor. They were building the railway over the to over the cataracts in the bottom of the Congo River, and he worked in that. He possibly did a bit of ivory trading, but there are very few references to him. He only wrote one letter back that I could find to his cousins in Northern Ireland. And the first real sighting of him is in 1890, when Joseph Conrad goes to the Congo to be a riverboat captain. He hadn't published a single word by then. he had the partial manuscripts of his first novel. But he comes across Casement on his first day in the Congo, and they spend 3 weeks together. And Conrad writes about him in terms that imply he really knew he knew the languages, he knew the people, and he was at home in the Congo.
So he'd been there by then for 10 years.
For 10 years.
And one, by implication, Conrad going there, it's as if he's been told the person you want to look up to give you the
absolutely
once over,
yes,
to show you what's what is this Irish guy, Roger,
yes,
Casement.
Yes, absolutely.
So
he wouldn't have appeared Irish by that time. I mean, everyone says he had a totally English accent, and most of his life had been spent in England, but the Irishness was inside him,
yes,
awaiting ignition. Yeah.
And so with Conrad, he spends 3 weeks?
They spend three weeks together, and Conrad writes about him striding into the bush with his dog at his heels. He always had bulldogs with him wherever he went, and going to the bush, and importantly for his later work, parleying with the, having palavers, as they're called, that's where the word comes from, with the local chiefs about, one imagines, trade and so on, about ivory. And so we know he spoke the local languages, which stood him in extremely good stead later.
And the country he's travelling in, what he's seeing is the Belgian Free State.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, it was...
Was it?
When King Leopold II of the Belgians sponsored Stanley, he was desperately jealous of his European cousins with their vast colonies in Africa. And he sponsored Stanley to explore the Congo River and to prove that it wasn't an offshoot of the Nile. And when Stanley had finished his exploration, the French had taken north of the Congo River, but this huge territory, bigger than Western Europe, Leopold rather brilliantly played off his cousins next off each other, and at a conference in Berlin, at which Leopold was not present, in 1885, the Congo was put under his control as a free state, as a free trading state.
So it's as if the French don't want the Germans to have it, and the, yes, Germans don't want the French,
yes,
to have it, and nobody wants the British to have it.
Yeah.
So they think the easiest thing is to let the Belgians have their playground, and then,
yes,
nobody else has got it.
But importantly, it was meant to be a playground that the Belgians oversaw, but it would be for the benefit of the inhabitants of the Congo.
That's
an, yes,
important aspect of it, isn't it?
Yes.
The way that they got, in a, the phrase, got away with it,
yes,
is that it was believed to be a humanitarian solution.
A very enlightened, exactly, that,
yeah,
would benefit the inhabitants, that any trade they produced at that point, ivory was the main trading medium, they would be paid for properly, recompensed, and be able to look after themselves. But quite quickly, Leopold, and it's important to stress that it was his personal colony, he ran it with although he never went there, but it didn't belong to Belgium, it was run by him personally, and the Belgian government had no oversight at all. But quite quickly, in particular when rubber became a very valuable commodity with car tires and electrical cabling and so on, as the 19th century got older, And the Belgian Congo, the Congo Basin itself, was absolutely full of rubber vines. And this was an extraordinarily lucrative crop. And when rubber became the prime export of the Congo, Leopold's hold on it clamped down, and his men, the force publique, as they were called, his private army, who were running the rubber trade, began to behave with terrifying ferocity towards the Congolese rubber collectors, to the point of shooting them if they weren't collecting enough rubber in a day, and to prove they were only allowed to use one bullet per Congolese. And so to prove they'd killed their person, they cut their hands off and took them back to be counted. So it was, that was quite a rapid development.
So ruthlessly exploitative.
Yes.
And the best known exposition of that, I suppose, is became Conrad's Heart of Darkness.
Absolutely.
But the material that fed Heart of Darkness, that was well known to Casement.
Yes, and Conrad says in his diary from this time, the stories he has told me and the things he has seen, which to my mind imply he could well have been the trigger for Heart of Darkness.
Mm. And at a certain point, though, something happens which means that Casement's quiet observations become public information. So, as I recall, the British commissioned him to do a report. Mm. Why did that happen?
Various things happened. First of all, there were stories coming from the mission statements, rumours of these atrocities. The other thing that happened was there was a Anglo-French shipper in Antwerp called E.D. Morel, who, when loading the ships, realised that what was coming in was tons of rubber and ivory, and what was going out was simply
it's
a handful of guns.
It's a basic thing. Yeah,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Yes.
The in column and the out column, they don't match.
Exactly.
There's a fiddle going on.
So this free trading state, he realised, was nothing of the sort. So he, Morel began to agitate, and this reached Parliament, and in 1902 they began to debate the Congo, and in 1903 Casement, who was now a consul in the Congo, he joined the diplomatic service a couple of years earlier, was commissioned to do a report, the Casement Report, as it became known.
So he then went back to the Congo using a missionary boat, which
yes.
enabled him to be, relatively speaking, unobserved. And he knew what he was looking for, mm-hmm. and he saw the horrors and catalogued them
yes.
in detail.
And he went further upriver than any other non-Belgian had been. Because he spoke the languages, he was, importantly, as you say, on a missionary boat, so no Belgian could trap him, as it were, by him using one of their boats. He knew the languages, some of the languages, there were hundreds of them, and he turned up at these mission statements, and because he was always, throughout his life, a wonderfully sympathetic man, and an empathetic man, after a very short while, these stories began to emerge. The Congolese poured out their stories to him. They followed the boat, desperate to tell him these stories. And his exploration lasted 10 weeks. And by the end of it, towards the end of September 1903, he was furious, shocked, and that was the moment that I think shaped the rest of his life, because not only was he obviously furious with the Belgian government, he was in a rage with his own government for allowing this to happen.
But although his own government had allowed him allowed it to happen, in a manner of speaking, they had also commissioned his inquiry.
They had.
And the inquiry, the report that he produced, had results.
It did have results, not quickly enough for him. So he spent the first weeks of 1904 writing his report. He'd also set up by this time with Morel the Congo Reform Association. He'd become very friendly with Arthur Conan Doyle, who was a passionate reformer of the Congo. And he delivered his report, which got remarkably little publicity, which upset him. But then he felt, and he was right to an extent, that this was such a humanitarian outrage, veering on genocide perhaps, that things weren't moving quickly enough. The wheels of international diplomacy were not moving quickly enough, and indeed it was a few years before Leopold was forced to give up control of the Congo.
Meanwhile, after his report was delivered, he's not going to get a job back in the Congo anymore.
No.
So he's footloose and fancy-free looking for a job.
Yes.
And gets hired, again, by the British. He's still a member of the Foreign Service. Mm. And they send him to Brazil.
That is some years later. So what happens, 1904, after he delivers his report and he's in this terrible rage, he goes to explore his route. He's always, to my mind, in search of his roots. Mm. So he goes to Ireland and starts working for Irish cultural causes, the Irish language, and he sets up a sort of fete with the traditional Irish weaving and singing and so on. And he becomes interested in that. But he has to make his living. He has no family money at all. So then he does rejoin the Foreign Service, is sent to South America, hates his first few postings, but ends up in Rio, very senior posting, does consular work then, which he doesn't much enjoy. It's basically,
but he's good at it, that boring consular work.
Yes,
so he's quite.
I think he is quite good at it, but he's bored by bailing out drunken English sailors and counting sacks of coffee and so on that are going to England. But that experience, his South American experience, then stands him in good stead when there's a business crisis, that there's a company called the Peruvian Amazon Rubber Company, where again there are whispers of atrocities coming out. It's run by a pair of brothers called the Arenas brothers, and what's important about the company, as far as the British are concerned, is that it's one of the very largest companies on the London Stock Exchange. It's floated at £1.5 million very recently, and it supplies something like 90% of Britain's rubber. So if this company needs urgent investigation, but if it goes bust, that has terrible repercussions.
The British, having got uppity about Leopold's atrocities in Belgium, in the Congo, suddenly find themselves potentially highly embarrassed by atrocities in their own distant but nevertheless backyard,
Absolutely right. So they send the best man available to investigate such matters, and that is Casement again. And he goes up the Amazon as part of a commission. He doesn't think much of the rest of the commission, who all travel on a company boat and seem to be pretty compromised in his book. But makes his own way there, arrives sometime after the rest of the commission, and finds, if possible, worse things going on, babies being thrown into fires and people being put in the stocks and then beaten between the legs and so on. And writes another report. This time it gets a huge amount of attention, public attention, unlike his Congo report. He goes to board meetings of the company, he helps reform it, and he plays an extraordinarily good diplomatic role, as well as a humanitarian one. And for that, he is knighted and he's by now a tremendous international hero. He's revered in America because of his work in Africa. And this really puts him on the
world stage. So rather suddenly, from being a nobody in the back end of the Congo, he's now an international celebrity, regarded in drawing rooms up and down the empire as being a really good man.
Absolutely, a good man to sort out bad things. But the other side of that is he's come to despise the British establishment, really, because although he's done this extraordinary work, he's never welcomed into the Foreign Office by the Oxbridge-educated establishment who run it. He's a man who's sent out in a crisis of uncertain origins. And so he's in this sort of strange position. And at that moment, that's when he becomes passionate about Ireland, because to my mind, he always needed a great cause to fulfill himself, perhaps psychologically speaking, because of this rather empty childhood. And he channels all that energy and emotion into Irish causes and tips over from just wanting to revive cultural aspects of Ireland into becoming a passionate home ruler and wanting to further
you get again the sense of him being a man of his times, because suddenly this passion for Ireland coincides with what is with political activities. So his temperament, whatever you want to call it at this point, takes a real scunner to the British establishment, as you said, but that becomes exacerbated, so far as I understand, by what he sees happening with the what became the Orange Men and in Ulster. So will you just take us through a very brief background to what was happening with Home Rule?
So Home Rule had originally been promised by Gladstone's government way back in the previous century. And then, for one reason or another, it had been put off. Asquith, who was then Prime Minister, was determined to deliver Home Rule. And Home Rule, in point of fact, wasn't in any way full devolution. London would still have oversight of Ireland.
It's not the same thing as independence.
No, not the same thing as independence. London would still run foreign policy and the treasury. But nevertheless, it was important. But within the Unionist Party, which later merged with the Conservative Party, there were people who were passionately opposed to it, certainly for Ulster. The Unionists began to take arms into Ulster to defend largely Protestant Ulster, of course.
It's important there I was startled when reading it. I was unaware. Here you have senior members of the British establishment, Carson, F.E. Smith, absolutely as pucker could be within the establishment.
Yes.
And they're bringing arms in.
Absolutely.
Actually, in a sense, to subvert what is happening within Parliament.
Completely.
It's a very curious thing.
It's a very curious thing. And the Irish Party in Parliament, who had held the balance of power in the Parliament in Westminster, were very much weakened because they seemed to be, under John Redmond, seemed to be Parliament's poodle.
Casement sees, in my understanding of it, Casement sees this grotesque hypocrisy happening in the heart of the establishment.
He does, and that further hardens his great antipathy towards the establishment. And he switches over and becomes radically Irish. He helps set up the Irish Volunteers in response to the to Carson and Smith and co. setting up the Ulster Volunteers.
What date are we now?
So we're now in 1912-13. Casement tours the country, giving talks, hugely well attended talks, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people sign up to be Irish Volunteers. Then the gun running follows, at which point Casement decides that the only solution is for the Irish Volunteers to bring in some guns as well, because they're heading towards armed conflict. So he sets up the gun running expedition that Erskine Childers and Erskine Childers' wife then carry out in the summer of 1914. So he is now 100% on Ireland's side. He's publicly speaking out against the government, and his destiny is set.
Then 1914 and the First War, mm. and his destiny is set. It needn't have developed in the way that to go to Germany at that point is a very particular choice,
yeah.
which he knew exactly what its repercussions would be.
He's always been pro-German, Casement, and way back when he was in Africa, he's saying the Germans really know how to organise things, and they're much better colonial masters than the Belgians, but than the British. And he goes to America in July 1914 in order to raise funds for the Irish cause from the Irish Republican. He's taken over by the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and he starts off very well. He's well known in America, as I say, and. But as war approaches quite fast by then, so we're in July and war starts beginning of August, the funds dry up. And he has what seems now a bit of a brainstorm, and has the notion that he will go to Germany once the war had started and gather German support for the Irish cause. Which initially meant weapons, which the Germans were very happy to send. But at some point between July and October, when he sets sail, he has the notion of raising a brigade of soldiers from the Irish prisoners of war in Germany, mostly from the Battle of the Marne, who will invade Ireland with German weaponry and officers, because he is terrified that Home Rule has been suspended for the duration of the war by Parliament, and he is terrified that if the Germans win the war, Home Rule will not be reinstated, so he has to get them on side right away. So he sets sail for Europe October
from America,
from New York, with the blessing of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and critically, he takes with him the only man with whom he had a romantic relationship in his life.
Now you're touching on a most important aspect which we haven't addressed, but carry on.
Absolutely. So he was homosexual. Nobody had any inkling that he was homosexual amongst his family or friends, and when it emerged that he was, 2 years later, at a critical moment, there was absolute consternation.
Let's come back to that. Meanwhile,
we will come back.
Arriving in Germany.
So he arrives in Germany with acting as his servant and also his lover, this Norwegian sailor called Adler Christensen, who's 24 years old, and Casement is now 50, and who he's met in New York. And they sail for Oslo, which is neutral, Christiania as it was called then. And well, it's quite handy that, of course, his companion was Norwegian. And on their first day in Oslo, before they go to Berlin, this was a wonderful thing to research, because we have Casement started a diary when he sailed to Germany to record these remarkable feats that he thought he would carry out, but also available in the National Archives in Kew are the diplomatic papers from the British legation in Christiania. And Casement's diary says on this first day that he sends Christensen out to do some shopping, and Christensen comes back in a high state many hours later and says he was accosted by a man in the hotel lobby who bundled him into a big fast car and took him to an address, and then said, "We know who you're travelling with." Casement had an assumed name, and "we want you to open his mail and tell us what he's up to." One can see from the papers in the National Archive this rather puzzled British secretary in the legation, saying, sending a telegram to London, saying a strange man appeared unannounced, insisting he had important information about Roger Casement, who he is travelling with, and he showed us various papers, and then it says, "I suspect them of having unnatural relations," which is then crossed out in the draft telegram. So Casement was being betrayed by his own lover and companion, but also knew that the British were onto him. And so that night he rushes immediately to the German legation and says, "We've got to get going." And that night they take the train to Berlin. But that was the final, that knowledge that he was being spied upon by the British, rather than being, he didn't know he was being betrayed by his own lover, is what turned him finally and irrevocably against the British government.
But he's crossed many lines by this point. He's from a British point of view utterly compromised.
Yes.
Already.
Yes.
He spends how long in Germany?
He's there from October 1914 until just before Easter 1916, so 18 months.
So he goes back in order to coincide and bring guns to what we know as the Easter Rising.
Yes.
But it's a fiasco.
But before that, he's been pursuing this scheme to raise the brigade. But that goes incredibly badly, because these soldiers, first of all, they all signed up, they weren't conscripted. The Germans put them all into one camp, and he goes and sorts them. They can't understand why this tall English, as they think, knight,
he sounds English,
is coming to see them in a German staff car. Their pay is going to their families, which is why they joined up, to get paid. Their friends are being killed beside them, and they cannot understand why they're being asked to invade their own country, not surprisingly. And the few that do sign up are simply, I believe, looking for a ticket home and would have deserted the moment they got home. In the end, only about 30 pledge themselves. And Casement gets more and more depressed. He sends Christensen to Christiania a couple of times with false information, which the British don't believe, and then Christensen comes back and says they want me to lure you into the North Sea and knock you on the head, and brings about, and his second Christmas in Germany is spent in a sanatorium. He has a sort of breakdown. Oh, meantime, his German hosts, he's been received at a very high level, he meets the Chancellor and so on, are saying to him, his friends in Germany are saying to him, for God's sake, you've got to get rid of that man, he's doing your case no good at all. So it's a sort of tragic time, and his time in Germany.
It's a tragic time, but when he arrives in Ireland and everything immediately goes wrong, but so, his arrival coincides with a sense of his own destiny suddenly meeting him.
Yes. So he realises that without proper German support, they've lost interest, really. The Easter Rising will fail. So he is determined to go back and prevent the Easter Rising, and he finally persuades the Germans to send him back on a U-boat with two companions. And he arrives on Good Friday, morning of Good Friday, as you say, determined to stop the Easter Rising.
Well, meantime, that's the irony, that he's trying to stop it.
Absolutely.
Because he knows it'll fail.
Yes. And meantime, the Germans have sent 20,000 rather rusty old Russian rifles on a ship that gets intercepted and scuttled, and so that's the end of the arms to Ireland. So on his first dawn back on in Ireland, in Kerry, on Banner Strand, they land on Banner Strand, quite lucky, I think, to get in on the rather ropey dinghy. Casement is exhausted. He's always ill. I mean, his time in his nearly 20 years in Africa has left him pretty weakened. I think he had recurrent malaria and all sorts of things. So he arrives with these two companions, who there's no welcoming committee because, unbeknownst to them, the Easter Rising has been put back to Easter Monday, and the local volunteers have been told on no account must any shots be fired before then. So his two companions stagger off into town, and he is exhausted. He hides himself in a ancient ring fort near the beach, where he's, and the dinghy they rowed into the beach from is spotted. He's quite quickly arrested. They don't know who he is. He's taken to the local police barracks and asked to see a priest on the grounds that he reckons a priest will be a nationalist and will help him get word to Dublin, but of course he doesn't. And that is his last night in Ireland after 2 years away, ever, because the next day he's taken to London on the mail boat.
So taken to London, and one understands that the British process, in a sense, that they've got a really high-profile man in the middle of the World War One who's been in Germany, on the face of it, plotting against the British. There's absolutely no two ways about it. He's utterly compromised. So he's tried for high treason. Mm. It's very interesting who the prosecutors are.
Well, the prosecutor is F.E. Smith, his old enemy in Ulster, who is now Attorney General. And, yes.
So is it a stitch-up?
No, the Attorney General would always try a treason case, but it adds to the disaster.
It adds to the disaster, but he was always going to be found guilty, really, wasn't he? But
but it makes it far, emotionally, far, far worse for Casement.
Highly personal. Yeah, it's not. Reading the account, one has the sense of it being profoundly personal.
Yes.
In F.E. Smith and Casement hate one another. And they hate what one another stand for.
Yes.
And one of them is prosecuting the other for his life.
Absolutely. And indeed, F.E. Smith, I think, behaved very badly during the trial when Casement makes a great speech, his greatest speech of his life, in fact, after he's condemned to death. And he says, if that gentleman would only trade places with me. So he puts him and Smith into the balance. And Smith walks out of the court saying, trade places with him, never. And very rude.
But there is, in a sense, a perfectly good explanation for Casement's defence, which is that he's not a British subject. Ireland is an independent country, in his view. From his point of view, he's like Garibaldi.
Mm.
He's not a traitor.
Yes.
He's a patriot to Ireland. He's not a traitor to anybody.
Yet the statute he has tried on is that he has sought aid from the enemy, which he undoubtedly has. I mean, he does regard himself as Irish, but at that time, to be Irish was to be British.
Yeah.
And he wants to be tried in Ireland, but that's not possible because high treason is always heard in London. And one of the things that shocked me was that no London brief would act for him.
Hmm. Why, so why is that?
Well, because he was such a clear traitor and because it was wartime,
yeah.
Which there's a sort of another terrible irony there, that the cab rank rule by which barristers have to act if asked came about when they were trying the Fenians 30 years earlier to ensure that they got a fair trial. So he has a brief from Ireland comes, a man called Sergeant Sullivan, backed by a man from America. George Bernard Shaw writes him a defence that his brief won't let him use. So there's a tremendous... he has a lot of people on his side, and the government are very worried about this.
And yeah. They're worried because if condemned to death, as the people wanted, or a lot of people wanted, he would be then a martyr to the Irish cause.
Absolutely.
So then there is this extraordinary move by the British establishment. They've got, by locating his personal effects, tracking them down to a boarding house in Pimlico. They found a lot of diaries.
They found his diaries from 1903, which the year of his Congo. It's really an appointment book. I mean, he just jots down, and because he never had any money, he puts down how much loaves of bread cost. There's nothing personal in them, even when he's doing his Congo journey, his last great Congo journey in 1903, it doesn't become personal. But in the first 6 weeks of that year, he's been in London, and there are references to his paying for men to have sex with him. And certainly, you know, so he goes to the theatre with Conan Doyle to see the Speckled Band one time, and then on his way back, he's staying in Hampstead. He has sex with a Welshman, unnamed Welshman, who he pays 5 shillings to. So there are these references to paid sex. And the policeman, a man called Sir Basil Thompson, who's interrogated him, has known about these for some time, but doesn't say anything to Casement. But between his conviction and his execution, there is a movement to reprieve him, and many people, H.G. Wells, Conan Doyle, John Galsworthy, they send a petition. The Archbishop of Canterbury goes to see the Prime Minister to appeal for his reprieve from execution. Our ambassador in Washington is sending a telegram saying he's worried that the Americans won't join the war because the Irish-American lobby is so strong and they're so pro-Casement. There's a resolution passed in Congress to reprieve him, and so on. Asquith, the government, you can see from the cabinet minutes, are sort of saying, are there any grounds for a plea of insanity? They're asking the Home Office lawyers. And the Home Office lawyers consider whether the homosexuality would be a plea of insanity, but have to dismiss it because it wouldn't stand up in law. And then this policeman, Sir Basil Thompson, photographs these 8 pages of the diaries and distributes them amongst newspaper editors, many of whom won't go near it. But it is known that these diaries exist. It's known he's homosexual, which is a shattering blow to those that know him. His best friend, who he used to go on motoring holidays with in Germany before the war, had no idea, and there's a very upsetting scene in the prison cell with him. So these photographs, the ambassador in America asked to see the photographs. The Archbishop of Canterbury is told about the photographs by an aide who's a great fan of Casement's, and this support falls completely away. And it's a desperately sad moment, I feel, in the book. Not only that, but the Irish stop supporting him too, because they can't, I mean, and to cut ahead a bit, his body is in Pentonville Yard for nearly 50 years because the Irish don't want him back because he's homosexual. So the diaries are put to, I think, wicked use. And indeed, many Irish historians in particular still believe the diaries were forged by the British Secret Service in order to discredit him. Absolutely not. I think that, apart from anything else, they were scientifically proved in the year 2000 to be by him. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons. Certainly, no one could have met the stuff in the Congo in the later in the diary never made it into the report. I mean, where he was and so on, because it all had to be anonymized, his Congo report, which was part of his reason for the rage against the British. So I absolutely clear they were real, and indeed we know about his relationship with Christensen, and there was another man in Ireland, so we know he was homosexual.
The book itself, yeah. I mean, it's an amazing account of a very complex life, these phases of his life which succeed one another, and you managed to condense it very remarkably. It's not a long book particularly, but he's a complex man, and one of the reasons he comes across as so complex is that he appears such an emotional man. He's driven by emotion over and over again in a way that, to read about, I find very moving. Obviously, especially towards the end, and the terrible, terrible dragging in of his sexuality, and which has as its backdrop unhappiness that he didn't have a good personal relationship with anybody, just these successions of meetings with people, paid sex. It's a very powerful thing to read about. It must have been upsetting in many ways to write.
Yes, it was. I was immensely saddened by him, that the fact that he had no connections at all with anyone. I mean, his orphandom, the only relationship he had, as I say, was with Adler Christensen, the only prolonged relationship. And what a wicked one. Which is a travesty. Absolutely. And I think by the time he was executed, he was quite resigned to that, because I think he'd sort of run out of emotion.
Did writing the book change your view of him?
It changed my view. I think he stopped being an enigma to me. I couldn't understand why he did what he did in Germany, and how he could go in this arc from great humanitarian
to... You explain that very powerfully. It comes across as...
But it was the emotional content that made me realise what had happened. I mean, and this goes back to his childhood, as I say, and his lack of upbringing, that he Joseph Conrad said, he wrote to John Quinn, that the Irish backer in New York, towards the end of Casement's life, and said his tragedy is that he's made his way by sheer emotion.
That was Conrad's.
Yes, and I think that's absolutely right. And he was not strategic. No one strategic, no strategic thinker could have done what he did.
You get sense of
that. But at the same time, the fact that he was pouring out emotion made him a great human rights reformer too. So it's a sort of
amazing humanitarian activity, which would not have happened without
absolutely
emotionalism. But
yes,
also the tragedy of bad strategic decisions.
Yes, absolutely.
Which make it a powerful and tragic life to lead.
No, I felt desperately sad for him at the end of his life.
I think reading it, one couldn't help but feel sad for this complex man, and there are many things in it which reflect on the world in which we find ourselves, the colonialism, attitudes towards homosexuality, all sorts of things which have powerful resonances now.
My conclusion is that he was a man ahead of his time.
Well,
and I think it's one of the things I realise is how very modern, as you say, he is to us now. Yes, he ran his life on emotion until the great world events, the First World War, meant he couldn't control things through emotion. He was overrun by outside life. Yeah.
Well, Roland Phillips, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for being on the podcast, and your book, The Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement, is a wonder, and I think that anybody will enjoy reading it, and I hope that we shall have some signed copies as well.
Thank you very much for asking me and for our great discussion.
And the wild waves sing his requiem.